I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to talk today to a novelist who grew up here in Baltimore. His name is Philip Mayer, and the novel is called American Rust. He's a man who's had quite a sojourn, numerous kinds of jobs, from bicycle messenger to bicycle mechanic, volunteering at the trauma center here in downtown Baltimore, dropped out of City. We'll talk maybe a bit about that. Grew up in Hamden, right around the corner from the studios. And this book, American Rust, that was written was... I was turned on to it by another guy I've interviewed a great deal who he grew up with, Will Hinton, who's a wonderful writer in his own right. And this particular book, as people have written about it, say it's a potential nominee for a Pulitzer, and I would go that far as well. And Philip Mayer, good to have you in the studio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. This is an amazing novel, as I told you before we went in the air. I'm sure everybody says that to you, so you know. It's a lot of good strokes, but it is really a phenomenal novel.
Yeah, keep talking. I love it.
But you grew up... right around the corner from these studios.
Yeah, I grew up right off the avenue, and we moved there in 79, so my father could go to graduate school. And Hamden at the time, like the rest of Baltimore, was it was hurting. The textiles went under in the 60s. Steel and the shipyards went under and began to take big hits in the 70s. Mm-hmm. The ports began to be automated, and so Hamden was hit by the general... exodus of jobs from the Northeast that that every other Northeastern city was hit by. So, yeah, it was an interesting place. I mean, it was there was a good deal of violence outside in the house. I mean, there's a guy who was almost beaten to death in front of our house, and one of the neighbors killed someone. Actually, a couple of the neighbors killed people that everyone knew about. And
Hamden was white gangster land in the 70s and 60s and early 80s at least.
It was. I mean, I want to be clear. Absolutely. I want to be clear that there was also a strong community. And I feel like that's what I want to make sure is not missed.
No, both were here.
Exactly. Both were here. And so those things, people knew who the bad apples were. And you knew that when this neighbor's kid was let out of jail, you should lock your door because he was a junkie and he was going to rob. So, but even though there was some degree of violence and there was, people didn't always even lock their doors at the same time. So it was strange. I mean, it was a strange mix of...
Much like Buell, the city you wrote about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
In this novel.
Yeah, yeah.
But so you grew up here, and at 16 you were in the A course at City, but you dropped out.
Yeah. I was – I always had problems with authority. So I think – I mean, I almost – I had to make up two classes in the seventh grade. I would have failed it entirely, but one teacher – the teacher who thought I was an idiot decided, oh, it's actually a really smart kid, and so she passed me out of mercy. And so I went to the ninth grade most of the way through, and I'd stopped going entirely in the 10th, and I think by the 11th, I was too young to drop out in the 10th, and they finally I dropped out.
So, but why did you drop out?
Well, I mean, I was just over school. I was over being told what to do. I was... bored. I wasn't that disciplined either. But it's strange when I look back at that period in my life, when I dropped out of high school was when I sort of began to get some sense of adult control over my life. And that was when I began to be happy in this strange way. Sort of I moved away from the lack of power that you feel as a kid that you feel frustrated by. And I suddenly felt grown up, which is not, I'm not, would encourage anyone else to do this, but.
Or not to, not to discourage or encourage.
Exactly, right, exactly.
You have to make your own decisions
exactly,
in life.
Right, exactly. Right. Yeah. So, I would do the same, I would do it all over again if I had to.
So, this book, American Rust, this is a novel that takes place in a small town called Buell, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That's a steel town, coal town that's gone dead.
Yeah.
Factories closing, people's lives. Trying to struggle, and you focus on these two young men, and a mother, and a police chief, and the sister of one of the young men, around how these lives are struggling to survive and what they go through.
Yeah.
So talk about that a bit, and if you want to set us up by reading something, that'd be great, and then we can talk about this novel.
Sure. Should I read first?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'll just read the opening couple of paragraphs, I think, which gives a sense of the place. This is chapter one, and this is from the point of view of the character Isaac, who's one of the main characters of the book. Isaac's mother was dead 5 years, but he hadn't stopped thinking about her. He lived alone in the house with the old man, 20, small for his age, easily mistaken for a boy. Late morning, and he walked quickly through the woods toward town, a small, thin figure with a backpack, trying hard to keep out of sight. He'd taken $4,000 from the old man's desk. Stolen, he corrected himself. The Nut House prison break. Anyone sees you, and it's Silas, get the dogs. Soon he reached the overlook. Green rolling hills, a muddy winding river, an expanse of forest, unbroken except for the town of Buell and its steel mill. The mill itself had been like a small city, but they had closed it in 87, partially dismantled it 10 years later. It now stood like an ancient ruin, its buildings grown over with bittersweet vine, devil's tear thumb, and tree of heaven. The footprints of deer and coyotes crisscrossed the grounds. There was only the occasional human squatter. Still, Buell was a quaint town. Neat rows of white houses wrapping the hillside, church steeples and cobblestone streets, the tall silver domes of an Orthodox cathedral. A place that had recently been well off, its downtown full of historic stone buildings, mostly boarded now. On certain blocks, there was still a pretense of keeping the trash picked up, but others had been abandoned completely. Buell, Fayette County, Pennsylvania. Fayette-Nam, as some called it. So this is obviously not a place I grew up.
Right. But there's some deep attachment, understanding you have of the power of the social and economic forces have on people's individual lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in some sense, maybe in some way I was writing about Hamden and Baltimore, but because the story is so much more complicated, because there's so many, because there you have the different racial migrations, the African-American migration into the city from the South, the white flight that began happening in the 60s and 70s, and then the general flow of jobs away from the area, of high-wage jobs, I mean, this is an important distinction, out of the area and, you know, into the South and then overseas. And so Baltimore, whereas southwestern Pennsylvania, the story's a little simpler. There's one industry that the entire economy was dependent on, steel. So when steel begins to go under in the 70s, you know, throughout the mid-80s, the area lost about 150,000 jobs in a very short amount of time, and it still hasn't rebuilt. And so I sort of wanted to show that story more clearly. What happens when you have an entire way of life built around stable middle-class jobs that go away, and what's the sort of human cost of doing that? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I think it's quite hard for me to write about the places I'm from. You sort of fall into a groove. You stop observing things. You stop noticing. It's much easier for me to go into a new place and kind of get the crucial details that tell the story and that show the right emotion.
Did you spend time there?
Yeah. I did a lot of research.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, one of my best friends is from the town that I based the Buell on. I did tons of, formal interviews. I interviewed tons of steelworkers, tons of folks who lived in the area, a bunch of public officials, cops. And I spent a lot of time walking. So I walked the train tracks. I did most of the journeys that the two characters do on foot. I did.
There's a lot of walking here. Isaac does a lot of walking.
Yeah, I did that walking. Uh-huh. And I jumped a bunch of trains, and I hung out in bars and just talked to people. And people are friendly. You know, you go up and you say, hey, I'm from out of town. Tell me about yourself. Everyone wants to talk, especially if you buy them a beer. I mean, then it's...
You buy them a beer.
Yeah.
You had one, too?
Yeah.
I'm sure.
One or two.
So, I mean, when people think of writing styles, and everyone has their own, and I'm always loath to pigeonhole a writer into someone else's world.
Sure,
but
yeah.
Having said that,
yeah,
reading your novel reminds me of several people.
Yeah.
And some have been alluded to in your book. Ernest Hemingway is one.
Yeah, sure.
And your style.
Absolutely.
This inner dialogue you have, inner monologue that goes on with your characters, all very different.
Yeah.
It's got this kind of darkness tinged with reality and light that like Cormac McCarthy has. In many ways. Though he's a tad darker than you, I think.
I think so, yeah.
He's a lot darker.
He's a lot darker,
than you are.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of dark in this book.
Absolutely. No question, yeah.
And Steinbeck comes to mind because of the way it moves through an American story in a place. But this is Philip Mayer. It's not any of those things.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah,
so
it.
What I'm saying, that style and what you're saying about the American condition, you spend a lot of time, it seems, talking about the human condition as you see it. through the inner monologue of these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the most important thing for me was to be honest with these people, you know, and to not. I mean, I love Steinbeck, but I think he occasionally, he occasionally sentimentalizes his characters.
Yes.
He occasionally doesn't present the full story. And so I wanted to just present people as they really are.
Rounded human beings with the foibles and beauty and warts that
absolutely.
We all have.
Yeah, and I think what you said about McCarthy, I mean, sure, there's that darkness because we all inside us have some darkness, but there's also some light. And I think if you're not showing both of those, you're doing a disservice, A, to humanity, and B, to the reader.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, all the characters, someone said to me, we were talking about this with a friend of mine who's a novelist, lives in St. Mary's County, Wayne Carlin, we were having at his place over the weekend. He said, somebody at the table said, if I can't find a character in the first 20 pages that I have empathy for, I close the book.
Yeah. 20 pages, man, I feel like it's like... Five pages.
Five pages.
You know what I mean?
Maybe he's being generous.
Yeah.
But your characters, for all the complexity they have and the darkness they have, are also empathetic. I mean, you like these people you're writing about.
Yeah.
Despite what they've done.
Yeah.
Even because, Virgil.
Absolutely. Because I think that I...
Who's the father of one of the characters.
Exactly.
One of the characters.
Yeah, well, but I think maybe that just reflects my view of humanity. I mean, I think that within all of this, there's a sort of human side, which I can think of like, okay, this is the love, honor, compassion, some willingness to sacrifice for others, and then there's this other side, which is maybe darker, maybe not, but this is this sort of the animal side that is afraid, jealous, willing to kill in some circumstances. And these are the things I wonder about. You know, where do we get our morality? You know, and does this define us as humans? How does morality change depending on the situations we're put under? You know, how, when does an awful choice become the only choice? So, yeah, and I think this is an intense book, but I realize you haven't finished it, so I don't want to give away too much. But, I mean, in the end, this book is of people who make the right choice when the going is the worst. I mean, it's one thing to be good when your life is... fairly comfortable and easy. It's another thing to be good when being good may come at the expense of yourself or your life. I mean, you know, and that is what differentiates us from, you know, the other creatures on the earth.
We can talk about your characters a bit here.
Sure.
And what they represent
to
you in this thing. You have Isaac English.
Yeah.
And his sister Lee.
Lee. Yeah.
Who are the two smartest kids in the valley.
Yeah.
Whose father was a laid-off worker and now in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
Whose mother committed suicide, we think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
We think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who is Mexican-American but hides it, hid it in her life.
Yeah.
And Lee runs off to Yale and Isaac stays home, even though he could have been anything because he was so brilliant.
Yeah.
He stayed in town to take care of his father, who they despise one another, but he takes care of him, but they love one another at the same time.
Exactly. Yeah.
Poe is this big athletic guy who's almost like, he's not dumb.
Yeah. But he doesn't value the intellect. He values physicality over, you know, even though he has a strong inner life, he doesn't assign value to his own.
All your characters have a strong inner life.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
I tried that. Yeah.
Because, well, let me get through this. I want to ask this question about the inner life. But
yeah.
So you have, and his name, Poe, and then his mother, Grace.
Yeah.
And the... who is a really interesting character, who's tried to get out of that valley by going to college and didn't, and blames herself for all the things that happened to her son.
Yeah.
And then the police chief, Harris.
Yeah.
Who's a really interesting, complex character, too, and is kind of that the embodiment of somebody who's the, how would I put him? I don't know, he's like the solid middle of the stories, trying to carry it all.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
So you have these characters, but all of them have these intense inner monologues going on, no matter whether they're super bright or not.
Yeah.
So you look at humankind as all of us having that quality.
Inside. Oh, absolutely. And I think that one of the this is something that we all do. You know, you look at someone, you assess you talk to them for a minute, you make an assessment about the kind of person they are, and maybe you write them off as having. Any sort of like deeper or more complex thoughts about life and mortality and their place in the world. But we all have this. And I think it might have been working at Shock Trauma that showed me this, because you see, you know, we saw a lot of people die, obviously. And I think that, you know, the average guy who I would have seen on the street and just thought, well, this guy, maybe he's a little bit of adult. But what you saw in those sort of intense situations in which people thought they might lose their lives, people had very, very complex reactions to them. And they had very, very complex views of their own lives and what was going to happen when they were gone and what was the purpose of being here on Earth. And yeah, and so it was crucial to me to show that, because I think there's a sort of there's a reaction when you see someone who's big and physical to think, oh, well, they don't have a mind, actually. But of course they do, because mm-hmm. all our minds are running 24/7, right. You know, whether we realize it or not.
And they never, and that's the, but so you're in the inner mind of women and men.
Yeah.
In this book.
Yeah. Which was hard. I mean, some of the characters were easier than others. Isaac and Poe, in some level, were the two sides of me growing up. Isaac was the geeky intellectual kid, which is who I was inside the house. We read tons of books. I mean, I don't remember learning to read. The favorite toy growing up was this automotive repair encyclopedia that my parents somehow let me get a hold of. And that was the thing they could not take away from me. I'm sure I was looking at the pictures when I was two, but at some point I must have started to read. So I don't ever remember not reading. I always remember loving to read and thinking about things and being curious about life and how things worked. And then outside the house, you can't really show that at all. I mean, unless you want to be beaten every day of your life. So outside the house, to be physical, you have to be strong.
Understand.
I mean, you know, you run from plenty of fights, but sometimes you have to stand up for yourself.
Right.
So you have to value different things, and you have to show other people that you value these things, and you don't show the intellect.
You don't show the intellect.
No, I think I mean, no, absolutely not.
Which
I mean,
is what Isaac does a lot. He hides it.
Yeah, he hides it from other
folks.
People. Yeah, yeah.
But so, in your own life, I was thinking about this. I was reading this book, and I really, you know, I'm about 10 pages from the end.
Yeah.
So, as I said to Erwin before, when I try not to get to the very end of a book when I have novels on. I don't want to blow the end by accident. So
yeah.
I'll get to it tonight. You and in your own journey, I was thinking about these characters. I mean, you dropped out of high school, did all these little things. Ended up getting to Cornell after the third try.
Yeah.
Went to Wall Street to pay off your loans.
Yeah.
In derivatives and things to destroy the entire world. You worked in that for a while.
Yeah, exactly. I've done my part.
you did your part.
Yeah, exactly.
Paid off
geez.
Your loans.
Yeah.
And then went off to become an EMT and a writer.
Yeah.
An emergency medical technician.
Exactly. Yeah.
And a writer. Even went to Katrina to try to help when the hurricane hit.
Yeah.
And you wrote about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in some ways, you've gone back and forth in your own life between, am I a highly successful intellectual guy doing this, or am I going to be an EMT guy and a bicycle messenger?
Absolutely. And I think those are the two. Yeah, I guess those have always been the I'm a pretty physical guy. I'm pretty mechanical. I love tearing cars apart. I love anything I can get my hands on and kind of figure out the inner workings. I mean, I love that stuff. And maybe in some way the sort of sense of people comes from that too. You know, how do people work, and I mean both physically, biologically, and you know, how do our minds work? So I think I realized that Wall Street wasn't for me. Okay, I didn't care about money, which is, you can sort of, it's easier to say that when you actually have a little in your pocket. So finally I had money. My parents never had it. So I go off to Wall Street, make money, and realize, oh, I don't care about this. Actually, I'm a writer. I have to do things that I'm interested in as I write. And so, yeah, I got the job as an EMT. I got a job working construction for a couple of years as well. And when the Katrina thing happened, it was just an obvious, I just moved to Texas. I was only about 10, 12-hour drive. And I realized, oh, well, I can make it there overnight. I can make it there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got there about the middle of the storm. So, and I'm also qualified. So what is my moral justification for not helping? There isn't one. So I went.
There.
So I went. So.
And you left.
And I left, that was still something that is, I have such complicated feelings about.
It seemed to disturb you when you wrote about it.
Yeah, it still disturbs me. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so what happened was I'd gone there, planned to stay for about a week. I just started this fellowship at the Michigan Center for Writers at the University of Texas. And so I'd been living in my parents' basement for a couple years, feeling a pretty deep sense of failure. At this point, I've been writing for 8 years. My writing hadn't gone anywhere. You know, as far as the world was concerned,
But you didn't stop, obviously.
No, I didn't stop. I kept going.
Right.
So I finally get some, you know, I finally get this amazing fellowship, which allowed me to write The American Rust. And So I go down, drive down to Katrina, and then I get a call from one of the administrators of the program. This is Monday, the first day I was there, saying, your registration's been canceled. You need to take care of this, basically. And so I'm thinking, well, this can wait a week. You know what I mean? Like, whatever. Mm-hmm. I didn't care. And then the levees broke. This is Tuesday. I've been there 2 days. And I'm talking to the chief of police, and that was the, you know, the EMT I'd attached myself to this police department. And the chief, it was the captain, said, so we're going to get 10 more feet of water. All the power is going to be knocked out. We're going to be stuck here. And it's going to be a month before you can probably leave. This is worse than the worst case scenario. And so, the rescue work was over, because we no longer had transportation. So the big military trucks we've been using, they could clear 5 feet of water. They couldn't clear 15 feet of water. So in some sense, the job there was over. In another sense, I realized I was maybe about to give up this thing that I'd worked for my entire life, which was a chance to actually write and be paid for it. And I still feel I have pretty complicated feelings.
But you were there.
I was there. Yeah. So exactly. Yeah.
And you took your skills to help human beings, and you did that.
Yeah.
We're talking with Philip Meyer right now. Two P's, Meyer. It's a new novel called American Rust. It's been getting a lot of play. Many people think that it's one of these that is potential being nominated for a Pulitzer. I think it's that good. Many people do. Very powerfully written, and one of those novels that pulls you in and holds you in. With full of empathetic characters and lots of darkness, but lots of humanity. So, Philip, so your view just of existence, of seen through these characters. I mean, you seem to say a lot through your characters that there are forces beyond your control.
Yeah.
That carry you through. I mean, I love you. More than once in this novel, people ponder the idea that the rocks will be here longer.
Yeah.
Than we are.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that this is like a crucial thing to figure out. Until you come to grips with the fact that life will always seem too short, it's difficult to draw meaning from it. I think Kierkegaard said this, and a bunch of other people said this. This is sort of a standard existentialist feeling of like, well, you must confront the fact of your own death if you were to live your life in a meaningful way. And I think all these characters do that. But I think most people do, too. I mean, this is something that we all wrestle with, something we're all afraid of. And the sense that life is temporary, in some way, is the only thing that gives it value. Maybe I'm sort of going off on a tangent here.
No.
This is something, yeah. So that the fact that we all know life is going to end, maybe in some way is the reason that we make an effort to treat others well. You know, it's a reason that we make an effort to be good people. And it is, in the end, what gives life its value, I think.
So when you put this novel together, I mean, you put it in this place where that was dying and people were trying to survive within it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to leave your home.
Right.
I mean, it's easy for people on the outside. And a lot of this is probably driven by my time on Wall Street, in which a lot of people did not have much sympathy for working class folks. You know, they were good people otherwise, but it was difficult for them to look at, a small town in Pennsylvania or Indiana or anywhere and say, you know, why don't these people just leave? You know, and I mean, the economic thing is the obvious one. Well, you need, you know, a huge savings account to pick up and move. But maybe the more important thing is that home is, you know, this is where you're from. This is where your loved ones are. This is where you identify yourself as yourself. You know, this is where your entire sense of self-worth and your entire sort of, you know, mental structure comes from, is the place you grew up. And so it's much harder for people to leave. It's very, very difficult to leave the place you're from, and even when the place is falling apart. And you see this throughout history. I mean, you look to the Holocaust. It's easy to look back now and say, well, why didn't all of those Jewish folks just get up and leave Germany? Right? It's obvious what was going to happen.
Right.
You know, but because people identify so strongly with a place, you know, you can't – the idea that you're going to have to give up this place and give up this – who you are people would rather face the worst consequence many times. So,
but there's also hope in these characters.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a very, very important thing. I think that that everyone, almost no matter what their situation, manages to see hope and beauty in the world. And because this is what keeps us going. There has to be some sense, well, tomorrow things might get better. And if I can just hold out another day, another month, another year, things are going to get better. I mean, I think even someone in prison will search for some small, beautiful thing, whether it's a bird that visits them every day or they can see a small patch of green, you know, outside. I mean, this is something that's fundamental to humans, is that we see beauty. You know, we need to see beauty wherever we are.
There's so many things I would like you, pieces I'd like you to read here to get our listeners a sense of
sure.
the points of this novel. I don't know what parts you'd like to try to share. I just turned to a place on 132 where Lee is actually talking about what you just talked about, why people can't leave, and why Isaac made his choice to remain in Buell. And I guess at the bottom of 132 you have this great, again, one of your inner monologues. This is her inner monologue, I think, when she's searching for her brother.
Yeah. This is the begins.
The brother's already, he's run off.
Yeah.
And is heading west. He thinks he can get to California and go to Berkeley, and he's been involved in this horrendous scene with his buddy Poe, in which some violence, serious violence occurred.
Yeah.
Poe is in the middle of taking the rap for some of this, and he's on his way.
And he's escaping. Exactly. And so the 132, this is outside the Charleroi. Okay. So I'll read some of this for a while. So this is from the point of view of Lee, Isaac's sister, who is wondering where her brother is. I mean, she knows he's taken off. She knows he's disappeared, and he's involved in this fairly horrendous crime. And she feels guilty because she herself has managed to get out of town and build another life for herself away from her hometown. Outside the Charleroi Hospital, she waited in the sun, high up on the hill, looking over the town, the immense cemetery across the river that occupied the entire hillside, stretching on as far as she could see. The cemetery seemed bigger than the town. She felt a surge of guilt. But Isaac had stayed here of his own volition. That was the only explanation she could think of. He visited her in New Haven once. It seemed to have gone well. He'd even gotten a sort of patron there, her ex-boyfriend Todd Hughes, who had offered to help Isaac with his application, who had asked after him a half dozen times afterward. But Isaac had never taken her up on her offers of further visits, and finally she had stopped offering. Maybe it had put a certain pressure on him to visit like that. She herself had not visited a single college. She had not trusted her own judgment at the time. She had presumed that her tastes would be provincial. And as it was, she thought now, it really was better to not go and see a place, simply to go by reputation. At 17, you'd pick a school based on nice architecture, or that a professor had smiled at you, or that your best friend was going there. You made your choices based on feelings, which were always bound, at that age, to be arbitrary and ill-informed and rooted mostly in insecurity.
It's good stuff. I just want to say there are parts in here that really, for you, as you reflect on your writing, say something about these characters and your kind of point of view that you'd like to share. I have so many pieces picked out, but I'd like to see what you would pick out.
Sure. So this is, let's read, this is a short section from Grace's point of view. Grace is the mother of Poe. She's been stuck in this town. She's hoping her sort of deadbeat husband, who's Poe's father, Billy Poe's one of the other main characters of the book, is going to come back to her. And she's feeling pretty trapped. And they live in this rural area outside this small town.
I like her a lot.
Thanks. Yeah, she's one of my favorites, too.
I like her a lot.
So we'll just read a short section from her point of view here. Grace Poe was sitting in the trailer in the shapeless gray sweatsuit she wore nearly every day now, even when going to town. She didn't know how long she'd been sitting there, staring at the brown panel walls and the worn carpet. She turned the TV off to let herself think. It might have been nearly an hour. Recently, she'd come to prefer this to the television, just sitting and thinking, crazy thoughts. She was imagining herself on a trip to the Holy City, a trip she knew she would never take. She was imagining herself on a steep rocky coast in Italy, all the old castles in the hot sun, hot and dry, easy on the bones, lots of wine, and everyone suntanned. Outside, it was not quite as dark as normal. The storm clouds carried the light from the town. She thought she'd seen her son coming up the road. Maybe she just imagined it. "You're turning into an old lady," she thought. "You're going a little bit crazy." It was either tragic or funny. She decided on funny, though she was annoyed at her son. They were out of firewood, and she was wrapped under two blankets, and it wasn't so much to ask, keep the wood split and the house warm. It was okay to be angry about that. It wasn't as if they were going to freeze. There were electric baseboard heaters, but they cost a fortune. It was out of the question to run them. The best thing would be installing propane or oil heat, but she hated living in a trailer, and for years she'd been hoping to move out of it. Buying a real furnace, sinking money into this place, it would be like giving up. It was better to be cold. She stood and went to the window, looking through her reflection, but nothing was moving in the road or the field, just the quiet emptiness that was always there. She had never expected she would live in a trailer, never expected she would live in the country.
These people, this is now.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is literally now.
Literally now, yeah. The book's set in 2005, right. Technically, but yeah.
I mean, even Hillary Clinton pops up in the book.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So it's...
And that was important. I mean, yeah. It was important to show that this people live like this right now. I think folks who read early drafts of the book said, is this set in the Great Depression? And they had no awareness. Uh-huh. I was like, no, this is how people live all uh-huh. over the country. I mean, this is the life for millions of folks. And so... After that, I realized, I have to be very careful to get contemporary references in there so people don't think that this is John Steinbeck time.
Looking at this, the way you do this book, one of the important things to me in this book was the fact that you wrote about it. You wrote about these very human characters, how easy it is to commit, be stuck in certain situations where you commit an act of violence that you had not intended to and were caught up in a place where you couldn't get out of.
Yeah.
Or you didn't think you could get out of.
Yeah.
And the fact these characters are white working class kids and people.
Yeah.
And not blacks, black folks or Mexican Americans is important, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of the America you talk about who might read this book don't know this exists. Don't know these people exist in their depth. That's something beautiful about the difference between you and Steinbeck, the depth of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. People don't know. And I think it's very easy. I mean, this is a sort of a crisis that's been going on for 30 years. I mean, we have witnessed since the late 70s the disappearance of almost the entire blue-collar middle class. I mean, this is a class of people that built the country. I mean, they ran all the factories. They built everything. They gave us a sort of social stability that we probably took for granted. Even in the last couple of years, I mean, I think like 3 million jobs these high-wage manufacturing jobs have gone overseas. And the important thing about that is that each time you lose a job like that, and this has been happening again for decades, is an entire family gets turned upside down, and that family gets put on a completely different path. You know, they get put away from the path of middle-class stability and having the good American dream into a life in which nearly every decision they make has enormous ramifications. You know, can they afford to pay the rent? Is hanging out with this person going to get them arrested? You know, are these small decisions, you know, being forced to leave this town, in this case, taking shelter in this place in a rainstorm, you know, are these decisions going to fundamentally change their lives? Whereas folks who are, especially in the upper class, you know, there's not much you can really do to get yourself bounced out. You know, you can't get, you know, it's very difficult to lose that. To really change your life, you have to mess up quite badly. Folks who are working class, working poor, it's very easy to go from that into prison, or go from that, you know, into homelessness, or from that into being killed.
And it's often a slide that you're not. People think you're in total control of your life.
Yeah,
you hear this all the time.
Exactly.
You know, you can do whatever you want to do. You're in total control.
Yeah,
this is your life.
Yeah,
But you're saying you're not in total control of your life. You're in control of parts of your life.
Yeah.
Or how you respond to life when things happen to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you are in control of making the best decision you can for the circumstance. But those externalities, those circumstances are determined by your family, you know, your background, the place you grew up, the people around you. They're determined by who is a strong role model in your community. You know, is it the guy who's 2 years away from prison, but he's charismatic and puts off a strong, you know, is a person that you want to emulate? Or is it the guy who's 2 years away from having a second yacht? You know what I mean?
Right.
And these are very different paths.
Right.
So.
Well, I can say this is just, I think that you've caught the sense of Americans struggling to survive and struggling to make it in a very tough world.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. So one of the other strange things is that in Europe, this book has been pretty popular. It's been translated into 6 other languages.
I saw that on your website.
Yeah. So because this is something that I think most Europeans don't see about our culture either. I mean, the same way that if you live in a city and have a white-collar job, maybe you're not quite as aware of these changes that are going on in our society. Folks overseas aren't either. I mean, this is a side of America they don't see that much. But it really is. You know, I mean, this is like millions or tens of millions of people now. And this is a part of our country in a very big way.
Do you still write every day?
Yeah. You have to. Yeah, I mean, I write.
So how do you write? Are you one of those people who gets up and does the early morning writing? You're late in the afternoon writing or late at night writer?
But mostly morning. You wake up. I run from the bedroom to where I work. Maybe drink a cup of coffee. I work for about 2 hours. Take a tiny break. Work for another 2 hours, and then maybe I read for a long time.
You literally run like you.
I want to be there within a minute or two of waking up. So, it's because you need to be in that dream state in which your mind is clear. As soon as you start checking email or even talking to another person,
it goes.
Your mind,
it?
Yeah, it kind of gets a little bit polluted. So you need to be able to, in order to step into someone else's head. Your own mind needs to be very clear. I mean, it's almost a meditative state in which you need to be receptive to some other person. You need to be able to inhabit the skin of another person. And how do you do that? Well, if you're thinking about checking your email and whether your bill's been paid and, you know, is your girlfriend or husband or, you know, what unhappy or happy, you're not going to be able to get into that state very easily. So, yeah, so I usually write 4 to 6 hours a day, but that includes about 6 hours of reading scattered in there. So I mean, it's usually like 10 to 12-hour workday.
Mm-hmm. Reading related to your writing or just reading?
Both. Sometimes I need something. I need to read some Faulkner or James Joyce to get myself into the – or Cormac McCarthy to get myself into the proper mindset.
Right.
And other times I need to read some nonfiction completely unrelated to clear my head. So, yeah, but it's all hard work. I mean, I think that this is something that is not – by folks who want to become writers. This is actually my third book. It's my first published book, but it took – spending 3-4 years on a first book, deciding that one wasn't very good, writing another book that I finished in 2003 that was rejected by every agent in the country. And and then the move into the parents' basement. And
you were accepted into Michener's School of...
The Michener Center for Writers. So finally... I figured things out in the parents' basement. I sort of asked myself, well, what is literature about and what is the purpose of this? And, you know, why do we read books and what differentiates good books from great books? And but I think I really had to come to rock bottom to ask myself those questions. I think that I had to get out of – I had to really decide I wanted this. And finally, I did.
So finally, I was just curious, what made you end up writing this book about these – five lives really.
Yeah, mostly five.
Five lives.
Yeah.
In this small town in desolate western Pennsylvania, that desolate because of the industry had gone, people were trying to... What made you put it there? That wasn't one of your places.
Yeah. The fact that it wasn't my place was a slight strong point. The other thing is, it's a much more typical... this is a story that's not being told that much. You know, that town could have been anywhere in the Northeast.
Anywhere.
It's very beautiful. So that in some way is nice. I mean, it's a physically very beautiful place. The area around Pittsburgh. It's rolling hills, green, river. And And because it also tells the story so clearly of America's, of the human cost of America's industrial decline. I mean, and that's what it's about in the end. This is where it's most clear what, where the result, this shows the results more clearly than almost any other, than a big city would, of what happens when we lose this class of people.
Well, I'm going to tell you that I love your characters. They're all people who you can relate to. They're real human beings. It's a real struggle. The interior monologues you create for us set the tone, and even your dialogues do as well.
Thanks.
And I want to thank you so much. Didn't know what to expect when I started reading this book. No idea.
Glad you liked it.
But it was wonderful. Philip Mayer, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
Philip Mayer was with us. His first published novel, American Rust. The New York Times, Washington Post, many other places just lauding this book. It is well worth the read, more than worth the read. He's going to become one of America's great writers, I predict. And Philip Mayer, good to have you in the studio.
Yeah, thanks. Take care.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to take a very short break and then come back to take a look at The City from Below, an innovative conference taking place in Baltimore this weekend, where grassroots activists, academics, and everyone in between will be invited to come together to rethink the city as we know it. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to mecu.com. Welcome back to The Mark Steiner Show. I remind you, The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. And I'm here with Veronica Dorsey of the United Workers and Scott Brzozowski, both City from Below organizers, and he is one of the founders of Participation Park, a community garden here in East Baltimore. And Veronica Dorsey and Scott Brzozowski, good to see you both. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's good to be here.
So I was really intrigued when I first saw this pop up on my Facebook, when I saw City from Below and read Emma's Cafe and other sponsors. So talk about what this is. What is this? I mean, it sounds like it's really broad in terms of its reach in community. Who wants to begin? Scott, go ahead.
Sure. The City from Below is a conference that we began organizing about 6 months ago with Red Emma's and the Independent Reader and a couple other groups. And the idea was basically to bring together for a weekend activists and organizers and also academics and theorists and artists to talk about issues related to the city, to social justice in the city. So it is a broad range of subjects. I mean, there are groups coming from all over the country who are working
really?
On... Yeah, I mean, there's people from New York, Miami, Chicago... And a bunch of other places, Philadelphia, working on a range of issues from housing and homelessness to urban agriculture and land use and workers' rights as well. And we kind of want to tie all these issues together by focusing on the city as sort of a place where all these things can connect with one another, where all these struggles can sort of connect with one another and strengthen each other. So so that's what's happening. It's this upcoming weekend, March 27th to the 29th.
And Veronica Dorsey, you're a spokesperson and work with United Workers, right?
Yes, sir.
So talk about why y'all are involved in this and what's the connection?
Our organization, we're a human rights organization, and we believe that all life is sacred and worthy of human dignity. And by us coming to this conference, we were asked to do a workshop. And our workshop will consist of Baltimore's human rights zones, geography of development and resistance. And just like everyone else at this conference, the different groups like SMEAC, Red Emma's, the Independent Reader, Algebra Project, all these grassroots organizations, which in Baltimore, it's amazing time for this. There's a lot of organizing going on here in the city that people aren't aware of, but it also gives us time for all of us to come together and share lessons learned.
So tell me, what for both of you, what this idea, what does City from Below mean?
Sure, no, I mean, for me, and I think for the other organizers, the City from Below refers to an idea of an alternative way of sort of producing the city that's, you know, more participatory and democratic. You know, we're so often urban planning and development and all these major decisions that sort of affect the city we live in are made, you know, by a few experts and sort of imposed on everyone else without their input.
So how does City from Below plan to kind of change that? What's the idea of what are you all going to do to affect that?
We want to focus, I mean, both on sort of a critical analysis of problems that, you know, we all know exist in the city. I mean, a shortage of affordable housing and all of these kinds of things. But we also really want to focus on people with creative solutions to these problems. So some of the groups we've invited are not only sort of analyzing the situation, but also doing some really interesting activism. For example, Take Back the Land from Miami has been doing some work where they're actually moving homeless families who have been evicted from their homes due to foreclosure back into those houses.
The homes they were evicted from.
Right, right. And another group called Picture the Homeless from New York just this week actually staged an occupation of a vacant building in East Harlem to draw attention to the vacant buildings and the fact that, you know, all the city's homeless people could actually be housed if those buildings were renovated.
So translate that for us here in Baltimore. What would that mean? I mean, what might come out of this? In other words, we have lots of vacant buildings in Baltimore. We have lots of vacant land in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. So what are you all going to try to get to with each other around those issues here?
Well, one thing we found out that if we come together as grassroots organizations and we come together, we'll have more power. And the more power and the voice you have, the more people will listen to you and we can get things done. It's like he said, the different workshops, we have an education and justice workshop from the Algebra Project, the Coalition to Save Libraries. I mean, you know, there's resisting university-driven gentrification workshops that SMEAC is a part of, Save the Middle East Baltimore. I mean, all these different organizations are doing things within their communities, and we felt if we all bring our work together in one room, we can accent each other's work and help each other and have more power as a collective, so the voices of the power that's in power charge now will be able to hear us, and they'll have to do something about it.
Scott?
Yeah, so it's about creating a space for people to come together to share ideas, to share strategies, but then to really, you know, talk about tangible solutions as well.
Well, there's a uniqueness to this, from my sense of what I've been reading about on the web and on Facebook, which is where I first found this. Was on the people, you know, blasting you on Facebook,
right.
Coming to the conference, City from Below, is that there's kind of it seems to be a unique marriage of groups here. Mm-hmm. It doesn't often happen. I mean, younger artists and political activists who might come out of universities and different communities in Baltimore with working class people in the city who are struggling to survive. It's kind of an interesting marriage you don't often see. I mean, that's what kind of intrigued me about this when I first saw that.
Definitely. No, I mean, just the opening panel on Friday night should be really good. It's at 7:30, and it's called Crisis and Resistance in the Neoliberal City. And, I mean, for just...
That
just
sounds like a pretty heady intellectual kind of university-style
well,
title.
Well, it's true. And one of the panelists is David Harvey. I mean,
I know
he's
David
a pretty
Harvey.
Distinguished
yep.
scholar who
right.
who
yeah.
taught at Hopkins for,
right, long time.
For a long time, and now he's in New York. So he'll be there, you know, coming from a more academic, theoretical perspective. But then Max Rameau, who's one of these organizers from Miami, who was doing the anti-eviction
work. Took
the
seizures of homes
exactly.
where people were kicked out of and they moved them back in.
Right, right. He'll be on that panel as well as another woman named Esther Wang from New York, who's from the Chinatown's Tenants Association, who's also that's also involved in resisting gentrification and displacement in Chinatown.
People don't realize that most Chinatowns are full of poor people of Chinese ancestry, not wealthy people.
Exactly.
People forget
right.
that a lot. Yeah.
So we definitely are trying to facilitate that kind of dialogue between people who are coming from a more academic perspective and also people who are really doing sort of on-the-ground activism. And hopefully the two can sort of enrich each other.
So I'm glad you brought that one up because, I mean, there's kind of titles even. That one title kind of kind of jumps back like a 1960s student radical kind of title of exactly. things you're going to scope into, but you're talking about something much broader than that in terms of the kind of dialogue you're trying to create here. Mm-hmm. So if you could both think about what do you want to come out of this? I mean, what do you want to, I mean, what would be the optimal end for you all in this conference? Of course, everybody's invited to this conference, right?
Yes, yes.
Please come down, you're saying,
absolutely.
Enjoy this, right?
Yeah.
Right. So what would you like to walk away with out of this on Sunday night?
A better sense of community myself. I mean, I wasn't born and raised in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And since I've lived in Baltimore, I've seen a lot of wrongs, and I just want to help make the wrongs right, you know, and organizing around social and economic justice is a universal thing. That's something that we can organize across work sites, across gender, across, you know, color, whatever. And it's something that everybody has in common because of human life being sacred and worthy of human dignity. And I think this conference, we can bring out this conference is unity. You know, if we work together, we can get things right, get things done with the diverse group of people we'll be working with during this conference.
Do you think that you can transfer some of the things that are happening in Miami, in Chicago, and bring those here? I don't mean like literally putting people back in their homes. And I mean, 30-some years ago, when I was a tenant organizer in South Baltimore, when it was still a poor neighborhood, the poor we were in, people used to literally do just that. People got evicted, you put them back in the house and change the locks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, so, but that takes a lot of heart and courage because you can go to jail for that.
Right. No, it's true, but I mean, I think there is a sense of urgency in the present, you know, because of the economic crisis and everything. And hopefully, you know, bringing some of these people who are doing interesting activist works in other cities will be inspiring for people here in Baltimore to get more involved and, you know, to work with groups like the United Workers and others to, get a little bit more serious, I think.
So, I mean, before we run out of time, I just have, this is on a kind of humorous note. I mean, some very serious stuff going on here today. Are you all going to have some fun, too?
Yes.
I saw the agenda, and I didn't see anything fun on the agenda, be honest. But it's going to be fun working with the different people and the different diversity of groups mm-hmm. there. And the fun of it is going to be the lessons learned. Like you said, you know, we have a chance of getting arrested, but those people in New York didn't get arrested. So what did they do to help them stay out of jail is what we want to know. You know, we're not just going to go take over something and go to jail. It would defeat the purpose. So the thing that I really want to take out of this is the lessons learned from the victories that each of these groups acquired during their campaign and during their existence.
And one other thing I should add is that we are offering free childcare all weekend long, and I'm sure that they'll be having some fun.
So where will this place be taking? Where will this be taking place?
It's at 2640, which is a grassroots community center and events venue on 2640 St. Paul Street.
2640 St. Paul Street.
Yep.
How do you get in contact to let people know
there's,
this is happening?
There's more information at thecityfrombelow.org.
And the webpage.
Mm-hmm. And what?
The webpage.
The webpage,
website.
Okay. Uh-huh. So there's no phone number, but you can go to cityfrombelow at redms.org or
yes.
cityfrombelow.org. Here we have a website, which is cityfrombelow.org, or you can write to cityfrombelow@redms.org. And this starts Friday, March 27th, which is just tomorrow. And it starts at 5 p.m. at Federal Hill and runs through Sunday evening. And I'll be at 2640 St. Paul Street, which is the old church at 26
exactly.
and St. Paul.
That's right.
Plenty of space there. And I love this idea. It hasn't happened in Baltimore in a long time, the idea that people from different communities crossing kind of artistic and political lines and racial lines coming together in one place is kind of a very unique event.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's because we found out poverty doesn't discriminate. You know, poverty is just not linked up to one group of people. We found out there's 60% of Americans in the United States are poor. There's more poor people than anybody. So
that's a very powerful point. So when this is over, we'll have to bring you all back for a series of shows to talk about what you all are doing and have you get in dialogue with people in power and see what happens.
Yes, thank you very much for your time, Mark.
We've been talking to Veronica Dorsey from the United Workers Association, Scott Brzozowski, who is a co-founder of Participation Park, an urban public art project and activist initiative. They are both part, he's one of the conference organizers, they're both part of the conference this weekend called City From Below, activists and artists and others coming together to talk about how to change this community. You should join them. Go to cityfrombelow.org or write cityfrombelow@redms.org. And Scott and Veronica, thanks. I'm dying to hear what happens out of this.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered to Clean Cuts by Andrew Epic and engineered to WEAA by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and to podcast any of our past show and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.